Welcome to today's program titled New Guidance on HIPAA, 9 Changes to Make. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. For those of you who are logged into the web presentation, you're encouraged to submit questions throughout the conference by selecting the chat pod located in the lower left corner of your screen, then type and send your question that way. At the end of today's event, a link to an online evaluation will be displayed on your screen. Please take a few minutes to complete it. We do appreciate your feedback. I would now like to introduce our host for today's call, Adam Green. You may begin.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Good morning, everyone. I'm Adam Green, a partner at Davis Wright Tremaine in our DC office. I work in the health information, privacy, and security, doing mostly HIPAA and other health information privacy and security law. And today we're going to focus on essentially some recent changes to HIPAA that some of them may have gone under the radar. The idea here is that there haven't been regulatory changes to HIPAA really since 2013. And so I think if you look at most organizations who have a mature HIPAA program, if you look at their policies and procedures, oftentimes they may be dated from either 2003, the original privacy date, 2005, the security rules original date, or 2013 based on some of the omnibus changes, but may not have been touched since then. And so today we're going to focus on some published guidance that OCR has put out and some initial things that we've learned from the audit program, and potential changes you may want to consider for your policies and procedures and HIPAA documentation based on those. I'll throw out the normal caveat. This is for educational purposes. This is not legal advice. Certainly look towards qualified legal counsel wherever appropriate. So some of the areas that we're going to focus on, and the initials here, CE, is things that are focused mostly on covered entities, BA, mostly business associates. And so first we're going to look at authorizations versus patient request forms, and then charges for patient access, notice of privacy practices, in particular with respect to the right of access language, and also access to treatment areas and potential limits on allowing people access to those areas. We're going to turn a little bit towards business associates with what is a use of protected health information and some guidance that we've had relevant to that. And then what is a disclosure of protected health information relevant to both covered entities and business associates. Conducting a breach risk assessment under the breach notification rule. How to treat business associates or subcontractor business associates in a risk analysis, and contact information for business associates and subcontractor business associates. So a little bit about the genesis for this presentation. We have a HIPAA audit toolkit. I think some on the line may already have it. And so in updating that for 2017, these are the areas that we thought merited updates to our toolkit. And so we're going to go through sort of what prompted those changes, and then we're going to provide kind of what we added to the toolkit for people to consider when auditing their own policies and procedures. So first, with respect to authorization versus a patient request form, so we had some of the most significant HIPAA guidance that we've really seen outside the regulations themselves since the start of the privacy rule. And that was early last year, a guidance on individuals' right to request access to and copies of their own protected health information. And quoting from that particular guidance, we had that a HIPAA authorization is not required for individuals to request access to their PHI, including to direct a copy to a third party. And because a HIPAA authorization requests more information than is necessary or that may not be relevant for individuals to exercise their access rights, requiring execution of a HIPAA authorization may create impermissible obstacles to the exercise of this right. So that's what the guidance said. This really came as news to, I think, most hospitals and healthcare systems out there, in that, at least anecdotally, what I was hearing was that most were actually using the authorization form that they provide, that they use for requests from third parties, they were using that same authorization form when a patient, or in the case of a health plan, a plan member, requested a copy of their own information. So this was a big change, I think, for most. And here's something taken from a OCR desk audit that highlighted that the entity's standard access request form, so essentially the patient request form, does not provide an opportunity to request access in a specific format. So not only do they, does OCR expect, the Office for Civil Rights expect that covered entities should have a different form from their authorization, but they have clear expectations of what should be in that particular form. So it's been a large area of confusion, kind of authorizations versus patient request forms. So I've got here a little table to a bit of a cheat sheet for helping understand the difference. So the main focus is who is the requestor. So if a patient or a plan member is the requester, and of course if they're the recipient also, that's a classic patient request. And you would want to look at using the patient request form there. The one that throws people off a bit sometimes is if the requester is a patient, but they ask that it be sent to a third party, that is also considered a patient request, although it does have some specific requirements that it has to be in writing and specify the name and address of the recipient and signed by the patient or plan member. So if the requester is a personal representative, and that is a defined term under HIPAA, so the fact that, say, a patient has a personal injury lawyer who wants a copy of their records related to a case, that does not necessarily mean that, and in all likelihood does not mean that lawyer is the personal representative. This is really someone who has healthcare decision-making authority on behalf of the patient, so the ability to really decide on treatment matters. So they stand in the shoes of the patient. So if the request is coming from a personal representative, and the recipient is a personal is that same personal representative, that'd fall under a patient request. Now, if the request is from a personal representative and they want it sent to a third party, it's going to be the same as if the request came from the patient, and that also should be a patient request. Now, in contrast, if you have a third party, even if they purport to be acting on behalf of the individual, the patient, or plan member, and the recipient would be that third party, that's a third-party request. That requires a traditional authorization complete with things like expiration date, etc. So the last one is the one that causes a lot of confusion and concerns, which is, well, what if the request purportedly is coming from the patient or personal representative, but it is forwarded by a third party? And the suggestion from OCR was that if a request is forwarded by a third party at the direction of the patient or personal representative, that's treated as a patient request, even if the recipient is that same third party. So, for example, the attorney that I mentioned before, they provide a patient's request and say that they are forwarding it at the direction of the patient. OCR seemed to suggest that that was actually considered a patient request, even though it didn't come directly from the patient and required a patient request form rather than a full authorization form. Now, OCR has gotten a lot of feedback about the confusion this causes and that this potentially eviscerates the whole concept of an authorization form, because third parties are frequently trying to use this rather than treating it as a third-party request. And OCR has indicated that they are going to do additional guidance in this area, so stay tuned on that. But you know, once you've distinguished between an authorization form and a patient request form, what are the differences between the two? So oddly enough, neither of them actually says you have to identify the patient, but obviously it's always a good idea to clearly identify the patient at issue rather than just have a signature that you might not be able to read. So good idea for either form to identify the patient. Description of the PHI. Good idea on the patient request form so that you know exactly what the patient is requesting. You know, they may not always want their entire medical record. They may want only certain time period or certain types of information. On an authorization form, you are required to have a description of the PHI, the protected health information. There is identification of the discloser. Not necessary on a patient request form. You know, the patient is coming to you as a covered entity, if you in the audience is a covered entity, and saying, I want information from you, there's not much question who's going to be disclosing. Versus an authorization form where it does need to be made clear who will actually be disclosing the protected health information, because that authorization form could go out to a number of healthcare providers. So the name of recipient, only required on the patient request form if it's going to a third party. Authorization form, it would be required. A description of the purpose. Now, the first time I actually ever used this table, I said that that was essentially not allowed under the patient request form. I've revised that a little bit because I heard a good comment from someone that says, well, I think they're maybe in Arizona. In Arizona, we charge a patient, under law, we have to charge a patient differently based on the purpose of why they're requesting access. So if they're requesting it, I don't know the law that well, but maybe for care purposes, it may be that they get it for free or something like that. You'd have to look at that particular law. So there may be a reason to ask for the purpose, but if you don't have a requirement under state law, you may not want to ask because arguably it's not your business why the patient wants a copy of their own records. In contrast to an authorization form where it's going to potentially be required, well, where it would be required to describe the purpose. So expiration date, I wouldn't recommend that for a patient request form. It doesn't really apply to that situation. Versus an authorization form, it would be required. Signature and date, certainly it's required on a patient request form if it's going to a third party. And even if it's not going to a third party, it's probably a good idea to have a signature and date on the patient request form. Authorization form, it's clearly required. And one of the main reasons that an authorization form is not necessarily appropriate, there's all these rights and warnings, like the potential for redisclosure, that really don't fit very well on a patient request form, especially if the patient's just requesting a copy of the records to go to themselves. Some people would like to see some of those warnings where the request is for it to be sent to a third party, like the warning that it will no longer be subject to HIPAA. But it's not necessary, and I think that's part of the obstacle that OCR had in mind, versus an authorization form is required. So form and format, it's a good idea, and actually based on that desk audit result, arguably it's required to include on the patient request form an opportunity for the patient to say what kind of form and format. So do they want it in paper? Do they want it electronically? If they want it electronically, do they want it as a PDF, in a text-based PDF? Those sorts of things, it's helpful to at least offer some space for the patient to specify that. Versus an authorization form, not necessary. Now, keep in mind, when you get an authorization form, you actually have generally discretion as to whether or not to disclose the information to that third party. And in fact, you know, if you want to offer them, offer to them that they can specify the form and format that they'd want, that's fine, but you have absolutely no obligation to do so where it's an authorization form and a third-party request. And finally, a warning if the requested form and format is unsecure. So for example, if someone says, I want you to email my medical records to my email account, and doing so, it's not going to be encrypted, it may be helpful to have on the form something where they acknowledge that they understand that there is some interception, some risk of interception by an unauthorized person as it goes over the internet. There is guidance from OCR that indicates that if someone requests unsecure access, you should give them some sort of warning, and so we're suggesting you potentially put it in the form itself. And you know, make sure they understand that, and if they do, then you are required to provide it unsecure as they've requested. Authorization form, not necessary. So on this slide, this is kind of the a screenshot from our audit toolkit, and I originally had some nice animation. The reason we came on a couple of minutes late is we did a last-minute switch because this platform doesn't allow for animation. But what you should see here is some text boxes where I've kind of pulled out some of the new questions from the that we've added to the toolkit that you and the audience can consider applying to your own policies. So, do you have an individual access request form that is separate from your authorization form? And does that request form, for example, provide an opportunity to request access in a particular form or format? So if your policies haven't been updated since 2013 and it doesn't address these sorts of issues, you may want to revisit them and think about maybe getting into some specifics in this area. So moving into the next area, permissible fees. This was another area that I think was a sea change in that a large number of entities were charging amounts for patient records that were not necessarily consistent with what OCR interpreted to be, quote, copying costs. And so in their guidance, they indicated things like photocopying time, scanning time, time converting electronic PHI to a requested format, transferring records to a portal or portable media, supplies to the extent that there are any, like paper, CD, USB drive, postage, time preparing an explanation or summary if requested by the individual. All of that time is fine. In contrast, reviewing the request for access, so you know, kind of the time going through and looking at the request and reviewing it, searching for and retrieving the PHI, that's actually always been in guidance as not allowed. Locating and reviewing the PHI in the record, so for an electronic health record, you may have to go to multiple places, a PAC system and the EHR itself, or it may be different places within the EHR that you have to pull from. Segregating and kind of getting all that together for being able to send to the patient, reviewing the records to ensure that information relates to the correct individual. You know, so good quality control is essential here, but what they're saying is this and other thing, and everything above is not time that you can actually charge the patient for. So I think OCR is more or less treating it as the cost of doing business related to HIPAA compliance. And so you know, if you are potentially charging for some of this time, it's something that you may want to go back to your policies and procedures and reconsider. So OCR in their guidance suggests three potential methodologies. Looking at the actual cost. So you know, this would involve actually almost having a stopwatch, if you will, for each individual request. I can't imagine too many people are going to be doing this. And then looking at the time versus the wage of the people who were involved in processing, doing that copying. And you're still expected to inform the individual in advance of the approximate fee, which seems highly challenging here where you haven't yet done it and you know done the stopwatch. So I don't expect too many people actually do actual cost. Average cost would be basically a time study where you calculate on average how much it costs to do hard copy records, for example, and you can do that on a per-page basis versus electronic copies. So how long does it take to actually copy these to particular media or to transfer them into a particular format. And the guidance says that electronic copies, at least where it's coming from an electronic record versus where you're scanning it from hard copies, that those electronic copies may not be charged on a per-page basis, which you certainly want to revisit your policies and procedures on that front. So they also offer a third option, a flat fee for electronic copies. It does not have to actually relate to actual or average costs, but the total flat fee, including labor, supplies, postage, everything, cannot exceed $6.50. I would highly suspect that there is no entity out there that has 2013 policies and procedures that include a flat fee of up to $6.50. It's something that was not really set forth in the regulation at all. So if you want to do that, it's probably time to update your policies and procedures accordingly. The guidance also says you must inform the individual in advance of the approximate fee that may be charged, which the regulation did not make clear that you needed to do. And you should also inform the individual of any associated fees that may impact the form and format and manner of access. So if paper records are going to cost $100 versus electronic records are going to cost $6.50, the guidance, which keep in mind does not have the force of law, but a court may grant some deference to, suggests that you should make individuals aware of these different options and the cost differences. The guidance also suggests that you should post on your website an approximate fee schedule. Doesn't say that's required, but it suggests that. And upon request, you should provide a breakdown, the guidance says, of charges for labor, supplies, and postage. So you should be able to essentially justify how you calculated your actual charges here. So we've got here a screenshot from the toolkit in the relevant area there, and we pulled out some information, which on my version of the screen is not coming out very well, but hopefully on your version, when you see this as a full screen, it looks okay. That essentially sets forth do your policies set forth the permissible copying costs that are allowed and potentially what's not allowed, and maybe get into the kind of the $6.50 and the not being allowed to do things on a per-page basis for electronic. It may be worthwhile to revisit all of those things in your policies and consider revising them accordingly. So on a related note, there's also the Notice of Privacy Practices, which most times if you look at a notice, it probably hasn't been touched since 2013. If it hasn't been touched since 2003, then you really need to revisit your notice. And this is, once again, only covered entities. We're not up to business associates yet who HIPAA does not require to have a Notice of Privacy Practices. So I've taken here a screenshot from the actual HHS Model Notice of Privacy Practices, which says that the individual is entitled to get an electronic or paper copy of your medical record. You can ask to see or get an electronic or paper copy of your medical record and other health information we have about you. Ask us how to do this. We will provide a copy or a summary of your health information, usually within 30 days of your request. We may charge a reasonable cost-based fee. I think it's it's got some detail, but it's not War and Peace. It's not two pages on the right of access. What we've seen in a desk audit finding, the entity's notice of privacy practices does not state the patient's right to timely access. I underline timely there. I'm assuming that's what was being focused on, because I can tell you there was information in this particular notice of privacy practices related to the right of access. And so the issue seemingly is not specifying the time period under HIPAA, which the time period of under HIPAA may also have state law issues there. So if your state has a 15-day period of time rather than HIPAA's 30 days, you may want to consider whether to get into that level of detail. Another finding indicated the notice does not include a statement that the covered entity is required to disclose upon request to the individual or another person named by the individual a paper or electronic copy of PHI. Once again, this notice did talk about the right of access. I think I've underlined here what I think was the focus was not specifying the right to an electronic copy. So if your notice does not talk about an electronic copy of PHI, you may want to think about revising it. And also another finding was the Notice of Privacy Practices does not contain a description of how the individual may exercise the right to direct the covered entity to send a copy of the individual's health and claims records to a third party. So just going back a slide, I don't read that the Model Notice of Privacy Practices actually mentions the right to have the copy sent to a third party. So maybe OCR may actually revise their model notes in the future on this front. But in the meantime, from what we've seen in audits, it looks like OCR may want to see that your notice of privacy practices specifically mentions that right to forward a copy of the record to a third party. So our toolkit actually includes a checklist from the Notice of Privacy Practices, and we have revised that checklist to include that you can receive a paper or electronic copy. You can receive a timely response, usually within 30 days, and that you can direct that the copy be forwarded to a third party. So we've revised our toolkit's checklist to also include that sort of information, since OCR and the desk audits seem to be looking for it. So this one, I think, really went under the radar for a lot of entities. And it came out of a settlement agreement that OCR issued, but they issued some related guidance. And they said, healthcare providers may not, and that underline was in the original guidance, allow members of the media, including film crews, into treatment areas of their facilities or other areas where PHI will be accessible in written, electronic, oral, or other visual or audio form without prior authorization from the patients who are or will be in the area or whose PHI will be accessible to the media. So what that means in practice is they're essentially treating it as a disclosure of protected health information if you let someone into a treatment area and they can see patients being treated. In the case of the media, even if they record it and then kind of de-identify the recording or attempt to do so, doesn't matter. There's been what OCR is suggesting is an impermissible disclosure by allowing media to just see patients being treated. So what's the applicability of that to other visitors, I think, is a significant question. So what about financial donors? So the big donor who just paid for a new medical wing, once that medical wing is operational, are you allowed to give them a tour or her a tour without getting a authorization from each and every individual who's being treated in that wing? I think it at least raises that question. Similarly, politicians who you may want to show off, you know, new facilities or why you may need more money to upgrade facilities, things like that. Are they treated the same as media, that they should not be in treatment areas without authorizations of all the patients being treated there? Law enforcement, especially if they've got body cameras, do you have an obligation to essentially block law enforcement from going into treatment areas unless one of the specific law enforcement provisions are met? Which, keep in mind, most of those law enforcement provisions, you know, limit the amount of information that could be disclosed to law enforcement rather than suggesting that law enforcement has unfettered access to patient information. So, you know, and I've heard OCR talk about that they may issue guidance in this area in the future, but for now, you know, should law enforcement be treated similar to media in that you may not be able to allow them in treatment areas in contrast to publicly available areas? Finally, patients visitors. You know, I don't think there's a problem with allowing patients to visit, allowing visitors to visit the patients themselves, but can you allow patients to just be walking around treatment areas unescorted where they can see lots of other information, lots of other people's treatment if they're curious? I'm not suggesting that everyone needs to go out there and immediately change and have processes to escort patient visitors. But at least I think this guidance at least raises a question mark there to consider. And keep in mind, there's also a security rule issue. There is guidance on the security rule that suggests, you know, visitors should not have access to electronic protected health information. So it may be worth revisiting what is realistic and reasonable. And if it's not reasonable to limit patients' visitors' access to treatment areas, then you may want to document that in your record. So in contrast, the guidance does say the privacy rule does not require healthcare providers to prevent members of the media, and I would suggest others also, from entering areas of the facilities that are otherwise generally accessible to the public, which may include public waiting areas or areas where the public enters or exits the facility. So you may want to think about whether to revisit your policies and procedures and try to draw a line between public areas and treatment areas, and have different requirements for whether it's media, who is certainly one of the highest risk areas, but also other third parties. What safeguards are you going to put in place to limit their access to treatment areas versus public areas? Those are potentially fine. So screenshot from our toolkit in this area, and we've pulled out that you may want to essentially consider looking at your policies on medias and other visitors to treatment areas, and whether you need to have authorizations in place there. So now something that's, I think, more relevant to the business associates in the audience. Thank you for bearing with us to the covered entity side of things. Some guidance that OCR put out last year that says generally, if a business associate blocks access to the PHI it maintains on behalf of a covered entity, including terminating access privileges of the covered entity, the business associate has engaged in an act that is an impermissible use under the privacy rule. So, under the security rule, there's supposed to be availability, and I think that's this has raised issues in the security rule, and this dates to relates to issues where vendors were more or less holding covered entity customers' protected health information hostage unless they, for example, paid an outstanding balance or something like that. So OCR had indicated before this guidance came out that they'd seen this and they were not happy about it. But this guidance goes one step further and says that act represents an impermissible use under the privacy rule. So think about that for a moment. Not doing anything with the information, specifically not allowing the information to go back to the covered entity, is treated as a use. I wouldn't have necessarily interpreted it that way before this guidance came out, because when you look at use, it's talking about seemingly affirmative acts of accessing information, utilizing information, things like that, rather than what is here more of a potentially passive act of not providing access to someone else, namely the covered entity in this case. So with that, we revised the toolkit for business associates to add guidance that we do recommend that you define what use is. It's the term use. People may not. The common sense view of the term may not be what people are thinking about for purposes of HIPAA. So it's helpful, I think, to include in policies and procedures the HIPAA definition of use and disclosure, which I'll talk about next. And here, specifying that despite that definition, even the act of withholding access may be a use. So another question, and this is relevant to both covered entities and business associates, what is a disclosure of protected health information? So on this slide, I've taken guidance that actually comes from back in 2000. And counterintuitively, while we're talking about disclosure, this guidance actually relates to use. But the guidance says, we interpret use to mean only the uses of the product of the computer processing, not the internal computer processing that generates the product. And this related to a question where someone said, well, if I run a computer query that searches through, say, 1 million records and returns 10, and so the person who runs the query only sees the 10 records, have I used all 1 million records that the computer process went through, or only the 10 that are returned? And so the guidance seems to be saying, well, the computer process itself does not qualify as a use. It's really only the human interaction, the human viewing of the product that constitutes a use. So compare that, though, to guidance that we found last year in ransomware guidance that OCR put out, where OCR, the Office for Civil Rights, said that when EPHI, Electronic Protected Health Information, is encrypted as a result of a ransomware attack, a breach has occurred because the EPHI encrypted by the ransomware was acquired, i.e. unauthorized individuals, have taken possession or control of the information, and thus is a disclosure not permitted under the HIPAA privacy rule. Now, there's a question about whether that's a breach or a potential breach, and I'm going to put that one aside. They kind of draw a distinction between a breach and a reportable breach, and I'm not sure that really fits well with what the regulations themselves say. Putting that aside, what we have here is that a computer program taking control of your information that is launched by an outside party represents a disclosure of information to that outside party, even if that outside party never actually lays eyes on that information because they've taken control of that information. Now, I've heard the arguments from OCR about why that's consistent with the existing definition of disclosure, and you know, there's certainly arguments there. But I think it raises a really interesting question with respect to that prior guidance on use and this idea that even if a human doesn't see it and doesn't necessarily have the ability to see it based on that type of the particular strain of ransomware, that there's a disclosure essentially just based on a computer program taking control. And so I think it's worth revisiting, as we've suggested in our toolkit, a new question that we've put in there. I think it's worth revisiting whether you've defined disclosure in a way to include control by an unauthorized person. And keep in mind, disclosure is not just relevant to this breach discussion. There's also things like an accounting of disclosures. And so even if you ultimately determine that the ransomware attack is not a reportable, quote, breach, this guidance suggests that you do have to account for it for purposes of accounting of disclosures, even if there's no exfiltration, even if the information does not actually ultimately leave your system and end up in the hands of the faraway hackers who launched the ransomware attack. So, on a related note, with the ransomware guidance, we also had guidance with respect to conducting a breach risk assessment. So this is a risk assessment to determine whether something is a reportable breach, not to be confused with a risk analysis under the security rule, which is looking at all systems containing EPHI and what are the threats and risks related to those systems. So now we're just talking about the breach notification rule and conducting a breach risk assessment to determine whether something is a breach. And the guidance says, although entities are required to consider the four factors listed above, and those are the factors that are in the definition of breach in the regulations. Although entities are required to consider the four factors listed above in conducting their risk assessments to determine whether there is a low probability of compromise of the EPHI, entities are encouraged to consider additional factors as needed to appropriately evaluate the risk that the PHI has been compromised. They go on to say, if, for example, there's a high risk of unavailability of the data or high risk to the integrity of the data, such additional factors may indicate compromise. In those cases, entities must provide notification to individuals without unreasonable delay, particularly given that any delay may impact healthcare service and patient safety. So this was a really big change to me. We've never had a definition of what actually constitutes a, quote, compromise for purposes of the breach notification rule. But when you look at the definition of a breach, it's an acquisition, access, use, or disclosure in violation of the privacy rule, suggesting that it's a focus on confidentiality. It's not in violation of the privacy rule or security rule, where the security rule is not just about confidentiality, but also covers integrity and availability of information. So I at least thought of that compromise is really focused exclusively on issues of confidentiality. And so a ransomware attack where the confidentiality of the information has not been compromised, first, I'm not sure I would have necessarily treated it as a disclosure before that guidance, but now we've got guidance that says it's an impermissible disclosure. So working off that, previously I would have said, you know, the focus is on whether the confidentiality of the information has been compromised. And what we see here is you should be looking at not just confidentiality, but also unavailability and integrity issues. And there's no question that those are very important issues and that those can have a dramatic impact on patient safety. I mean, if you get hit with a ransomware attack and are turning ambulances away because you can't take new patients at all at this time, that impact is monumental. But I wouldn't have necessarily treated it as a reportable breach in the past. And this is really suggesting that, yes, if you have that level of a lack of availability, OCR may be treating that as a reportable breach now. And so we've revised our toolkit assessment tool with respect to breach notification rule to also include questions about whether your policy doesn't have to require it, but at least has you considering the impact of availability of PHI and considering the impact of integrity of PHI when conducting a breach risk assessment. Not required, but OCR seems to be making, I think, the fact they're making this suggestion, I think, is a strong indication of where they're going on this front. So the next area that I've included is now turning from a breach risk assessment to a security rule risk analysis. So arguably, this is the most important thing you can possibly do under HIPAA, because my experience has been if you are investigated based on a breach, if it involves any electronic information, and possibly even if it doesn't, they will ask for a copy of your risk analysis. And if you are audited under the security rule, they've asked for a copy of your risk analysis. And much of the settlements to date, the financial settlements and fines, have been over risk analysis issues. So this should be a really huge focus for any covered entity or business associate. And there's always been a question as to what extent are you expected to include your business associates, or if you're a business associate, your subcontractor business associates, in your risk analysis. I don't think it's realistic to address all the risks facing them. So if you use a cloud provider, for example, I don't think you can realistically address the risk level related to every risk facing that cloud provider. Have they addressed SQL injection? Have they addressed this, that, and the other thing? I think the expectation is that business associate, that cloud provider in that case, should be conducting their own risk analysis, governing risks to the information that you maintain on their systems. And then you should be conducting a risk analysis with respect to your own systems, or at least the things under your control, like the password that you set for that cloud provider. But what we have here in this guidance on cloud service providers is, in particular, outsourcing storage of other services for ePHI overseas may increase the risks and vulnerabilities to the information or present special considerations with respect to enforceability of privacy and security protections over the data. Covered entities and business associates, including the cloud service provider, should take these risks into account when conducting the risk analysis and risk management required by the security rule. So, in short, the guidance is indicating that certain high-risk overseas business associates, I'm not necessarily talking about ones located in Europe who may have even more stringent privacy and security requirements than we have in the States. I'm talking about ones in countries that may have a lack of law that can be enforced against them, or may have particularly high rates of hacking. I'm not going to name any particular countries. I think everyone knows who they're probably thinking of here. They are suggesting that you should pull those business associates specifically in your risk analysis and identify them as potentially having a higher risk, which leads to the question, should all business associates be assigned a risk level? Which would be a fairly Herculean task. I mean, if you have a risk analysis and you have, I know of entities who have, I think they've purported 2,000 business associates. To include each one of them in your risk analysis and assign a different risk level, this one gave us a SOC 2 report. We think it's low risk. This one filled out our questionnaire rather well. It's a low risk. This one is in this foreign country, and we haven't gotten any real assurances they've got security in place. It's a high risk. To go through that process is a fairly monumental endeavor. Or is this suggesting that only for certain high-risk ones, BAs that you know are high-risk, are those the ones that you should be specifically including in your risk analysis? Do you need to separate risks out by confidentiality, integrity, and availability? So, we have a lot of faith in the confidentiality of this particular business associate, but if we've got a network outage and the information is unavailable, we want to address that risk, or we don't have confidence in their availability. Or is it enough to lump it together and just assign a risk level related to confidentiality, integrity, and availability overall? And can business associates be grouped if you take the view that all business associates should be addressed in your risk analysis? So, for example, we require business associates to do a SOC 2 report, and we've gotten that from 95% of them, and we treat that, therefore, as low risk of confidentiality, integrity, and availability, versus for whatever reason, we don't have that for these business associates, and here's the corresponding risk level. So I think I've covered that. So in our toolkit, we've added a question of whether you are including certain business associates, such as overseas subcontractors who may be higher risk, in your risk analysis. So contact information for business associates is the last area I'm going to touch on. So in the on the OCR website, when they talk about audits, they said, the following is a list of the specific information that OCR is requesting about business associates. Covered entities should provide the requested information to the best of their knowledge. So this is not an absolute. This is to the best of your knowledge, and include the name and types of services provided by each business associate. Please include a secondary point of contact if that information is available. Covered entities responding to the request should identify each element for each business associate. And then they go on to say that you should, for each business associate, ideally be able to provide the name, the type of services provided, a first point of contact, including first name, last name, address, phone extension if needed, fax, email. They list all those items for a second point of contact and a website URL for the business associate. Now, keep in mind the purpose here. This was not that OCR was auditing covered entities and potentially business associates on whether they maintained this information on all of their business associates or subcontractor business associates. This was not, if you don't have this, you fail. This was because OCR does not have a yellow pages, to the extent that's still around, of business associates. They do not have a listing of all the business associates out there from which they could pull and create a list of who they're going to audit. So they needed to gather as much information as they could from covered entities, and I'm not sure if they did the same thing when they audited business associates with respect to asking about their subcontractors. But they needed to pull this information so that they could, create a universe of business associates from whom they would start to audit. And what they've said publicly is they were able to gather 20,000 information about 20,000 business associates or so. So we've included in the toolkit a potential question about, do you maintain a kind of a centralized database of information about your business associates? And if so, do you have primary and secondary contact for them and a description of the services they provide? I can tell you pretty much no one prior to the audits had that. I don't know of any entities who had second contact information for most or even necessarily any of their business associates. The question is whether now that you've seen that OCR audits have included this, and this may have been a one-time thing, they may never ask for this again, but whether you want to start asking for this information in the future. So here's information about our audit toolkits in case you want to learn anything more about that, or of course feel free to contact me. And for those who on the call who already have toolkits, we're going to be upgrading, we're going to be updating shortly, and you'll have free access in the extranet to 2017 versions of the toolkits that you've already purchased that have these additional questions. So, you know, we will continue to provide people access to updates of the toolkits. And if you have any questions, here's my contact information. And with that, I am going to check out our Q&A section and see what questions we potentially have, which let me try to make this so I can actually read it on my side. Okay. So one question, doesn't this last category, and I think this may date back to when we were talking about access requests, doesn't this last category depend on whether the request is presented in the form of a HIPAA authorization or an individual request? I think it's a good point. I mean, I'll give you an example of how confusing this can get. And so once again, we're talking, I think, about distinguishing between a patient access request versus a third-party request for an authorization. I've seen where a hospital receives a request and it says, I, the law firm, request a copy of this patient record. And attached as a separate page is an authorization form. I would treat that as a traditional third-party request with an authorization form. But then that same request included a third page in which the individual says, I, the individual, request that a copy of my record be sent to my lawyer. And so suddenly we have both an authorization form and a patient request form. And very hard, you know, I think, you know, there's arguments as to how you should treat that, although maybe the safest way to go would be potentially to be treating that as a patient request. But certainly, if you get a request from a third party that on its face is a third-party request and includes an authorization form, then that's a traditional authorization disclosure, versus if the request on its face says, I, the patient, am requesting, then you should consider whether that is an individual request. It certainly suggests that it may be. And if you don't have the information you need, you would want to provide the individual request form in that case rather than a full authorization form for the patient to fill out. So another question is, often there is no documentation to substantiate the personal representative's claim that he or she is a member's personal representative, meaning there is no guardianship or like document, and the patient is not able to confirm deny due to capacity reasons. In these instances, what is recommended to confirm deny personal representative's claims of authority to act on behalf of the patient? This is a tough one. There's not much guidance there. I think it's going to depend on the circumstances. Certainly, if a minor comes into the emergency room with a parent, I don't think OCR has any expectation that you're going to refuse to treat the parent as a personal representative unless the parent is able to present records. If someone purports to be a guardian, I think professional judgment will count towards a lot here, but if someone, after the fact comes in and says, I'm a guardian and would like a copy of the complete medical record, it may be wise to try to get documentation of their guardianship, which hopefully they will be able to readily provide. I'm not talking about, once again, in a patient emergency, letting this issue interfere with the ability to treat the patient and disclose relevant information to the guardian. I'm talking about if they make a more formal request, it may be appropriate to ask for guardianship papers at that point. But here, once again, this is not individualized legal advice, and this is going to be very fact-specific that you should consider. So what are the certain elements that need to be in a patient request? So I think we covered that, hopefully, subsequent to this question in a later slide. Does the letter from the third party have to state forwarding at the direction of the patient? If not, can we send it back stating that it's invalid? So if the letter comes from a third party to a it purports to be on the patient by the patient. So if I get a request from an attorney, for example, and the request says, "I, the patient, request that you provide me a copy of the information," and the attorney says, "Give it to me," then yeah, you can say we can't give it to you, the attorney, because it doesn't say that. It should specifically say that the information would be forwarded to the third party. So hopefully that answers that question. Do costs need to be broken down when a flat fee is assessed? If you're going with a flat fee of up to $6.50, you do not need to have a cost justification. You seemingly are fine there based on what I've seen in the guidance. Is there a definition for acquisition? There actually is not a definition for the term acquisition, although there is some, and I think this may relate to the definition of disclosure and what is an acquisition. There is some guidance with respect to, and I think the omnibus rule includes some guidance that says use and acquisition, access and acquisition are forms of use and disclosure and kind of fall within those umbrellas. So that's the most we've ever gotten at that point, to my knowledge. Does your toolkit for BAs rely on a particular NIST framework? No, it's actually just focused on HIPAA, and it provides essentially, you know, on the security front, the idea is not that you're going to be able to use our toolkit and have perfect security. It's really focused on HIPAA compliance. So, for example, you could be following the NIST framework and have great security. Our toolkit's security side is really focused more on, okay, but you still have to do certain documentation, even if you're following NIST, to comply with HIPAA. And so that's kind of more of the focus of the toolkit. We often have physicians request a copy to the patient. How should those requests be handled? Are any forms required? So if a request is coming from a physician and they want a copy to the patient, well, you always have the freedom to disclose protected health information to the patient. So that never requires a form. And this also may fall under that it's for treatment purposes in this case. So let me skip down a little bit. How do you handle specifically protected health information such as mental health, STD, HIV/AIDS for a patient direct request when it's not specified by the patient? So it's a very good question, and essentially OCR's right of access, at least according to OCR and the way I interpret the law, will trump any more stringent requirements that state laws may have where they further limit the right of access. Because for purposes of HIPAA, if you are further limiting a patient's right of access, that's not considered to be more stringent. And so if you have a state law that, for example, says you may only disclose information on HIV if you've got a form that has X, Y, and Z requirements, but you have a patient that says, "I want my entire medical record to go to this third party," you cannot say, "Well, I'm not going to follow HIPAA and provide that, that patient's record to the third party as requested by the patient because the request does not comply with state law." So you really, those state-specific laws can't stand as an obstacle to HIPAA right of access. Now, in contrast, I will throw out alcohol and drug abuse, where it's governed by a federal regulation. 42 CFR Part 2 is a different story, and you do need to comply with 42 CFR Part 2 in addition to HIPAA. So with that, we are past the top of the hour. So, and I think I actually got through all the questions that I'm able to see right now. So I'd like to thank everyone for attending, and I hope you found this informative. And we will be following up with you. Thank you, everyone.
Have a great rest
of your day.
Thank you, Adam. A link to an online evaluation is, wait, get it up on your screen here. Here we go. Okay. Also, if you would please take a few minutes to complete it, we do appreciate your feedback. I did have several people inquire about getting the slides, and that's available in the Handouts tab that's on the left-hand side of your screen. Just double-click on the file, and then depending on your computer, it will either ask you to save it or it'll just download it directly. So this concludes today's webinar. Thank you all for attending. Everyone have a great day.